So welcome to the third Sunday of Lent. For those of you that haven't been with us, we're doing a series on letting go based on this quotation that I won't read because I've read it the last 2 weeks, but that's what we've been doing. And so the first week, what we're doing is every week asking you to let go of something. And so the first week, we asked you to let go of distractions through giving some kind of a media fast. Last week, I asked you to let go of the rat race, and I've had several of you talk to me about like working through the Enneagram was a really helpful exercise because it helped us identify the ways in which we need to specifically let go of the things that keep us busy all the time. And so for some of us, it's control issues. For some of us, it's anxiety issues. And for some of us, it's performance and the need to get you all to like us issues. And so I want to spend a couple minutes just letting you, if you're willing and if you're open to talking in front of everybody else, if you want to share with everyone maybe what you gave up last week and then tell us how it went. And failure is always an option, all right? You can name it as failure. I hope you do. That's also part of the thing. So let me just give you space. How'd it go last week? Why the thumbs down? I was really bad at this one, all right? What else?
I'm very comfortable when I know what I'm talking about and I know what I'm doing. I love being in that space. So I put, I meant by relinquishing mastery, giving up the need to be as good at how I'm performing or how I'm presenting myself to my level of comfort. So then this past week, I applied to grad school for an analytics program at Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
And so there was this struggle of, you know, my personal statement and my resume have to be perfect.
Yeah.
And I'd say I basically failed at resisting the impulse to make them perfect.
Yeah.
But that exposed for me a kind of a deeper, I'll say, distrust of things that I learn in church that impact major life moves. Because I've been burned in the past from making major life decisions based on things that I learned in church. So it was a similar kind of a resistance.
Wait. Are you putting down like making major life decisions based on what you learned in church?
Kind of.
Okay.
If I feel dissonance,
yeah,
between what I've learned in church and a bunch of other stuff that I've learned over the course of my life.
Right.
So the idea that, you know, be careless and casual in this application to graduate school. I've had many other experiences that tell me that's not a good idea.
Right.
So anyway.
Fair enough. Yeah, Courtney's right behind you.
So Dave did a great job and set the bar really high on this. I'm just going to bring it down a notch for everybody who set the bar a little bit lower, like myself. So this week I decided, if I had to like stop controlling something, probably something that takes up a good portion of my time is straightening the throw pillows on my couches, throughout my entire house. I walk around like all day neurotically, like relining them and like picking them up off the floor. Like it's gotten so bad. Like I'll put my kids in the car and I'll run back inside and put them all back on the couch so that when I walk in, it's like, ta-da. So I decided this week I was going to stop straightening the throw pillows and I did so good. I'm so proud of myself.
Well,
I only picked them up twice.
Like, yes.
I was like texting pictures to Jennifer of them on the floor. Like, I'm just breathing. I'm really breathing through this. Like,
yes.
But I did it. So sometimes I'm like, every once in a while I'd be looking at my kids. I'm like, can somebody please pick that up? Like, please. Like, yes. Do they have to stay on the ground?
Yes.
But sometimes I just sat there and I rolled with it. So
that's
if you
lovely.
Set the bar lower, don't be afraid to share.
Thank you. One or two more. Oh. Kaylee's got one. Uh-oh.
I gave up M&Ms, and it was hard because I couldn't eat them, and I love M&Ms.
Yeah, doesn't everybody love M&Ms? And you were able to do it all week long? Wow.
And I still haven't even touched them since the beginning of Lent.
Wow, all the way since the beginning of Lent. Well done. Thank you. Okay. I'll let Danny go, and then I'm going to share one from somebody else that's not here today.
So I actually didn't give up anything. I added something. I'm usually pretty critical of myself and harsh on any decision that I make or anything, but pretty gracious to other people. So my idea was to try to give myself the same grace that I give to other people. Mm. And a lot of that was just positive self-talk. And you know, I think it's actually been a pretty good week. So,
cool. Thank you. So I want to share one with you that somebody put on. They're not here this week, but they put it on Facebook. So I figure it's fair game if you put it on Facebook. I was off Facebook mostly this week, but I needed to get on for something on Monday for work related, and I happened to see this one post, and so I screenshot it, and I've read it like four times all week, and every time I read it, it makes me smile. So some of you know Andrea Brock. They're a little bit newer here. This is the picture she put on Facebook of the back of her car on Monday morning. So that's, you see the chaos there. And if you know Andrea at all, you know this is not the way she is. So I want to read what she wrote, because I even read it again this morning and got teary because I just think it's so lovely. First, a disclaimer. No, this is not food for my family of ravenous boys, although I'm sure they wish it was. It's for the students at Dunlap Grade School during testing week. Second, notice how it's all a hot mess? This, you love this, don't you, Courtney? After checking out at Sam's Club, I was in the middle of the snowy and slushy parking lot trying to meticulously stack and organize all these boxes in the back of my van. A young, mentally handicapped man graciously asked if I would like some help. Then he asked me if I was any good at hot potato and proceeded to pick up boxes and toss them as fast as he could to me and in the back of the car. My first reaction, pure panic, because I'm a control freak, ha. Huh? Then I watched his face and started cracking up laughing and tossing boxes as fast as I could too. He high-fived me when we finished and told me I was really good. But what's funny is that just yesterday I chose to give up for Lent the urge to control everything, to try to make it perfect, to stop being so obsessed with my to-do list that I miss these God moments because of my busyness. So I'm grateful for this mess. Grateful for the young man that made me laugh and cry driving home from Sam's Club. Hashtag, there's beauty in, whatever. Isn't that lovely? I just thought what was really lovely about that is the idea that I'm going to give up control. And then she got to have this moment on a snowy Monday morning with this kid in the middle of Sam's parking lot, which I just have this great mental picture of her and this kid laughing and chucking stuff into her car, right? And when we want to control and we want to hang on, maybe she would have missed a really beautiful moment. Isn't that just awesome? And I know not every Lenten fast gives us such beauty or gives us such, you know, poignancy, but that one was just so like, oh, that's what we hope for. That's what happens when we let go, is we create space in us to enjoy the life that God's offering instead of having to control it or have anxiety or whatever our thing is. So this week we're going to transition to talking about letting go of privilege. And I know already some of you, that word strikes all kinds of chords with you, and we'll get there eventually. But first, I want to talk about fear. It was, the Christmas of 1992, I was 19 years old, or 18 years old, I guess. I was a freshman in college, and we went to school in Ohio, and so Christmas break started, and I got a ride from Ohio down to my aunt and uncle's house in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I spent a couple days at my aunt and uncle's, and then my parents drove down from here and met us in Chattanooga, and then the whole family, aunt and uncle, cousin, and my family, we all caravanned ourselves down to my grandparents' house in Florida. And so when we got down there, I said goodbye to Jennifer at college, and I hadn't seen her for a couple days, and when we got to my grandma and grandpa's house in Bradenton, Florida, opened up the front door, and Jennifer was standing in my grandparents' living room. She had surprised me, and my Christmas gift was that she had surprised me and flown down and spent a week with us in Florida, and then flew back, like, I think on the 23rd or something, to go back and have Christmas with her family. So super exciting, super fun, yay, big surprise. And my dad had been slow driving all day long, and I had been calling him old and really irritated with my dad all day because he missed the exit to my grandparents' house. And we've gone there dozens of times. Like, what is wrong with you? You're getting senile at 40. No, my dad was 39 when I was 19. Anyway, no, he had been 41. He had been 41 then. My mom would have been 28. 38! 38! My mom was 38 when we got married. Yikes. Anyway, y'all are doing math. You can hear the stories later. So that night, Jennifer and I went out on a walk, and we're in a strange town. We're in Bradenton, Florida. It's late at night. It's like 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and we decided to go on a walk so we can be together, go make out. And So we are on a walk, and we're on this busy road. I think it's 69th Street, and we were walking in Bradenton, and a car passed us this way. And then I noticed that car come back past us a little bit slower. And then that same car went about two blocks ahead of us and pulled into a driveway to do a three-point turn. And everything in me like was like, oh, what's happening here? And so we took off running. And we ran the half mile all the way back to my grandparents because we were super, super afraid, right? Now, looking back on it 20 years later, we probably had nothing to be afraid of. They probably just thought they recognized us. So there's probably no reason. Statistics say there's no reason we should have been scared. But in that moment, nothing but pure unadulterated fear. Somewhere around that same time in my life, I don't know if you remember this, Aunt Karen, there was a night where I was home alone. My whole family was gone. Do you remember this? She's laughing at me already, and you're all going to laugh at me in a minute. So we live out in the country, and it was kind of dark and scary, and I have a wild imagination and love to read all kinds of things that stoke my imagination. And I was home alone, and nobody was there, and I got home late at night, and I got to my bedroom and probably locked the door because I'm a freak like that, And then I thought I heard the sound of somebody coming up the basement stairs. Like I could hear footsteps on the stairs. And it freaked me out. And so I called Aunt Karen, who lived 2 miles away. And I was like, Aunt Karen, somebody's in my house. At like 11 o'clock at night, I called her. He probably woke you up. And so her boyfriend at the time was like, I'll come out and make sure you're okay. And then while I'm on the phone with her, I hear the bedroom door. Like the bedroom door wasn't totally tight in the jam. And I could hear it like thumping. Like somebody was pushing on the door. And now I'm really freaking out. And because like, somebody's in the house and I'm all alone, I'm gonna die. And then like rational thought caught up to fear, right? Because that's what happens sometimes is we get afraid and then rational thought starts to catch up and I start to think through like, why would somebody who wants to kill me sit outside my bedroom door and just play with the door? And so I finally screwed on my courage and opened the door, and our cat was sitting outside our bedroom door. Now, I need to be fair to myself. I look like a total... Anyway, the cat never wanted anything to do with me, but it was just that my dad was gone. So he was hungry for any kind of affection and was coming to me as last resort, is why he was at my door. I could tell more stories, right? We could all tell stories about times in our life where we're irrationally afraid of things. And our behaviors, now that we look back, we're like, I'm embarrassed that I was so afraid of this thing. I'm embarrassed that I was so afraid of that job change, of that location change, of that thing that happened, right? If I set up an open mic and said, come and talk about times in your life where you've been irrationally afraid, we could all tell stories and look as silly as I look. But there's also times where our fears are actually real. In fact, our fears are why our ancestors survived. You know, like the people who weren't afraid got eaten by the dinosaurs, right? Those of us that were a little bit afraid, we hung back in the caves and we survived, right? So fear is good, but sometimes our fear just runs away without us. Do you know then, somebody counted, I've heard Richard Rohr say this, that somebody counted, he doesn't even have a source, that 365 times in the Bible, that's a funny coincidence, 365 times in the Bible, the phrase, do not be afraid shows up, or some version of it, fear not, don't be afraid. Because for all of us, not just the fives and six and sevens in the room, we talked about Enneagram last week, not just the fives and six and sevens, they get it in like a double dose. But all of us wrestle with our fears. All of us are challenged by our fears all the time. And that's maybe one of the reasons that one of the most oft-repeated commands in the Hebrew Scriptures is this one. This is from Exodus 22. It's just a couple chapters after the giving of the Ten Commandments. Don't abuse or take advantage of strangers. You remember, were once strangers in Egypt. If you read the Hebrew Scriptures, this command, I think if I remember what my rabbi friend said, shows up more than any other command in the Hebrew Scriptures. Here it is in Deuteronomy. I'll give you a couple of versions of it. Deuteronomy, you must treat foreigners with the same loving care. Remember, you were once foreigners in Egypt. Reverently respect God, your God. Serve him, hold tight to him. Back up your promises with the authority of his name. He's your praise, he's your God. What I wanted you to see in this one is look how it ties how you treat foreigners with your reverent respect for God. Because you reverently respect God, because you love God, you treat foreigners with the same loving care that you treat each other, because you were once foreigners in Egypt. There was a time where you were in Egypt and you were the foreigner, and you remember what it's like to be a stranger. You remember what it's like to be a foreigner. And so treat them in the way that you would have wanted to have been treated back then. Here it is from Leviticus. This is the last one I'll show you. When a foreigner lives with you in your land, don't take advantage of him. Treat the foreigner the same as a native. Love him like one of your own. Remember that you were once foreigners in Egypt. I am God, your God. So every time this command is given, it's rooted in their own experience. There was a time that you were a foreigner, so remember what it's like. Remember what it's like before you had a home, before you had a place, before you had a people, before you had a land. Remember what it was like so that you will put yourself in their shoes for a minute and try to treat them the way that you want to be treated when you are like that. So let's pause right there. Let's reflect back on the scriptures. What do you hear? What's sitting with you right now? And then I'll move forward. Yes, yeah. That's great. So what Joe's saying, for those of you that are way over here, is his experience of being deployed and being in a place where you don't know the language, you don't know the custom, and you feel, I don't know if you've ever been in this experience, you feel very off kilter. I'll give a little plug for Honduras, and we're going to do this again. That's one of the experiences of going to Honduras, is we intentionally put ourselves in a place where we don't know the language and we don't know the culture, and we're a little bit on our heels. We are the outsider. We are the stranger. You were still saying more, and I interrupted you. Was there more you wanted to add to that? Yeah, so part of it's a clash. I think what you're experiencing is part of it's a clash of civilizations where, especially in Middle Eastern religions, Judaism, Islam, this idea of hospitality is such a huge deal. Like, it's an honor thing. You treat people with hospitality and your honor is at stake in those moments. And American culture is very far removed from that, right? I'm not just talking current. If you look at the history of America, it was the Irish, it was the Italians, it was the Poles, it was every group that came to the United States. There was a time where they were the other and they ought to be feared and kept at bay, because something about America says we fear the stranger and we despise the stranger, keep them away. And so that's part of our DNA and part of a challenge, especially in an American context, of love the stranger like you want to be loved. Yes. Yeah, so that experience for you of being in foster care and being the new kid all the time. Yeah, man. What it's like to be the other, period. So like we've institutionalized this in terms of freshmen, right? So like the idea that, hey, there's this new crop of kids in the high school that don't know anything. Like, let's make sport of them. Like, that's part of our, like, thing, right? That's part of what it is to be American. That's a rite of passage. That's just what it is. You haze the new person. You make the new person feel more ostracized. Keep them at bay, right? Like, we do this. There's a lot of directions we could go from right here, right? And some of you are really nervous that I'm going to get really political really fast. This is the only thing political I want to say. I don't care what your political positions are, but if you call yourself a follower of Jesus and you believe in what the Bible says, and your conversation about refugees and immigrants does not include a serious wrestling with this passage, your position isn't a Christian position, it's just a position. So I hope you go home and I hope you have conversations about what ought my attitude ought to be as a follower of Jesus, as a believer in the Bible about refugees and immigrants, because the Bible has a lot to say about how we treat refugees and immigrants, and we ought to be having those conversations. I'll stop being political now, okay? Because I think it's bigger than just how we treat refugees and immigrants, even though I think that's a big deal. It has to do with all the ways, and I like the example you used, because it's all the ways that we think about the others. Whether it's a difference of skin color or socioeconomic upbringing, or I have to admit sometimes, this is so shallow and so dumb, but when I hear people talk with a southern accent, I kind of think they're dumb. That is the dumbest thing. That's this, right? Like, oh, bless your heart, right? Like... That's ridiculous. But we do it because of sexual orientation. We do it because of skin color. We do it because of gender. Because we're more experienced in our field, any way that we can find to make ourselves feel better that, hey, I'm better than you, we just naturally go to those things. And some of it is just driven deeply, I think, by fear. We're afraid of what we don't know. We're afraid of the things that we don't understand. And so we keep them away, and we don't want the cost of getting to know somebody else, of standing up for somebody else, for investing in the other. And yet scriptures always are reminding us to do that. So the word that this brings up is privilege. And the danger here, I think one of the things that keeps us at bay is privilege. Now, I know that's a political term, and some of you already are tuning me out because you feel like I've gotten political just by using the terminology privilege. All privilege is it's a special right, advantage, or immunity granted or available only to a particular person or group of people. The Dean family has privilege to walk into our house at any time they want. You all don't have that privilege. That's all privilege is, right? Certain people get certain things. Like, okay, some of you work at Caterpillar and you wear an ID badge. That privileges you to access to buildings that I don't have access to. You have probably a keypad card, right? You can get places in the hospital that I can't. I can get places in the hospital that you all can't. I can go after hours and visit somebody. And I just have to say pastor. And they're like, all right, come on in, right? Always with the look like, really? You don't really look like one. It's the one time in my career, I've said many, many times, it's the one time I wish I had a collar. It's like when I go to the hospital, because if you wear a collar in the hospital, you don't much go anywhere. We're not going to tell that guy no, right? That collar gives you privilege. And the challenge about privilege is most of the time we're just blind to the privilege that we have. We don't think about it. I came across this cartoon, but I thought it was really good, so we're going to look at a cartoon for a minute, because why not? It's Lent. This is Richard. His parents are doing okay, and this is Paula. Her parents, not so much. Richard's house is warm and dry. His shelves are full of books, and his fridge is full of food. Paula's house is full of people and not much else. It's damp and noisy, and she keeps getting sick. Richard's parents will do anything for their baby, and they're praising him, and so will Paula's. That's why they're working two jobs. Richard goes to a great school, well-resourced, good kids. His teachers love their job. At Paula's school, the class sizes are large, the school is underfunded, and it looks like her teachers are tired, stretched thin from the stress. So maybe we can see why the expectations set for Richard, and both of them have a B here. So, and a B plus, his parents are getting him a tutor, and her parents, B, hey, not so bad. And over the years, all these little differences, parents paying for his education, her working a job while she goes to school and still getting in debt, they start to add up and building into something bigger. So on the left panel, his dad's getting him a job because he knows somebody, and hers, she's tending to her sick parents. And because each little difference sneaks by unnoticed, that's the point about privilege. It sneaks by unnoticed. We don't even recognize how, because of the color of my skin, my gender, my sexual orientation, the fact that I'm part of the majority of religion in America, because of my socioeconomic class, I have all these little differences that sneak by unnoticed. Then maybe Richard starts to believe that he deserves to be on top, that he did it all by himself. And maybe Paula starts to settle and learns to know her place. But I hope not. And then this is the second to last panel. So somebody's asking him at a party, what is the secret to your success? She's working the party at the same party. And then he says, less whining, more hard work, I say. I'm sick of people asking for handouts. No one ever handed me anything on a plate. You see the irony in that? But we say those same things all the time. Or we hear it said all the time. When we first started out as a church, we worked down in River West. And so if you don't know River West, it's down in south end of Peoria. It's transitional housing. It's people who are somewhere between public housing and on their own. So it's mostly Section 8. People pay a portion of their income for the rent. It's subsidized by government, but not fully. And so the first couple years of our church, that's where we were super active, is down in River West. And we did a program every week and all these things. It was a really great time. And I got to know a person named Monique. And I may have told Monique's story at various times in our journey, but it's been a long time. So Monique was one of the moms down in River West, and I knew her dad really well. And Monique had, I think, two little boys, and I think her boys were the age of our two oldest boys at the time. And I was sitting and talking to Monique one night and asking her about what her goals were. And Monique told me that her goal was to be a nurse someday. She wanted to be a nurse. And so, but she couldn't afford to go to nursing school. So her plan was that she was going to cut hair And then whatever little bit she could scrimp and save, she would scrimp and save so that she could afford to go to nursing school. But before she could cut hair, she had to go to hair cosmetology. Thank you. I could not think of this word. Cosmetology school, which is a year-long program and costs X number of dollars, and she didn't have that money. So right now, she was working two jobs, I think like McDonald's and somewhere else, to save the money so that she'd go to cosmetology school. So her plan was to work at her job, save money so she could go to school, so she'd get a better paying job, so she could save money to go to school, so she'd get the job she really wanted. And almost every one of us in the room, if our kid wanted to be a nurse, we would just send him to nursing school. And years ago, I got in my mind this idea that it's like being on a track, right? And if we all lined up on the track and I claimed the inner lane and consigned you to the outer lane, David Lynn, even though you're faster than me, you are faster than me. You're so faster than me. But whatever. I put you on the outside lane and I'm chugging away on the inside lane. And then I get to the finish line and I go, ha, look at me, I beat you. The rest of you would look at me like, you're such a fool. You weren't smarter. You didn't work harder. You didn't do anything more than he did. He just had a lot further to run to get to the same place you got. And then you claim that you did it all through hard work. Here's what I want you to hear. Some people get really defensive when we start talking about privilege because all of a sudden they're like, what do you want me to feel guilty for what I've done and what I've accomplished in my life? I don't want you to feel guilty. That's not my goal. Congratulations. You've worked hard. You've taken advantage of the opportunities God has put in your path. Good for you. And I mean, I'm not being sarcastic. Good for you. We should all use our gifts to the best of our ability. It doesn't behoove society or ourselves or our own pursuit of God for us to run with hop on one leg so I can keep even with David. But rather, the injunction to the Israelites is remember that there was a time where you ran on the outside lap. So figure out ways how to shorten the outside lap so they can run the same lap you did because you used to run out there too. And so the goal in Christianity and the goal of our spiritual growth is that we try to find ways to shorten that lap so that we can all get there. Not just so that I can get there and say, look at how I did it. I got the inside lane and knocked it out. But rather so David can have a shot at getting around this track too. The problem for Monique is if any one part of her plan goes wrong, the whole thing is derailed. And I think that's why he keeps saying to the Israelites, hey, I know that you live in the land now. I know that you have the privilege of having homes and you have a land and you're safe and the grapes are like whatever, the land flows with milk and honey. I get it. Everything's good for you now. But remember, there was a time where it wasn't so easy. And so find those people where it wasn't so easy and do something for them. Treat them like you would have wanted to be treated when you were on the outside laps. Part of our family lore, the stories that we tell our family over and over again, is my dad is the one of four boys. His parents divorced when he was 7 years old, I think. And then his mom married a guy that had three boys and one other boy that just lived with them for some strange reason in the 60s, 50s, 60s, you could just do this. And three boys in Marshall. And so my dad grew up in a home with eight boys and his dad was a bricklayer. And so my dad tells stories about like in high school, he had like two shirts and he swapped them out with his brothers so they didn't have to wear the same shirts every day to school. They'd have to just like trade shirts because they don't want to be embarrassed by that. In fact, my dad says that part of the appeal of meeting my mom, he says this, like part of when he fell in love with my mom is he fell in love with grandma is because she treated him good. You probably remember that. Like when my dad, like she treated him well. She loved him. She made him meals. And so my dad went to the apprentice program at Caterpillar and worked his way through the company and went and got a degree and he worked hard running on the outside lap so that I could run on the inner lap. So that doesn't mean I get to sit on the inner lap and then wag my finger at all the people out there, but to remember where I come from, remember my roots, remember that I was once a stranger, I was once another. So how do I make the pathway short for them? I'm gonna go long, but I really, really wanna show you this video and I really wanna read you a poem, okay? So I'm sorry, but we're gonna go a little long. This video is from a guy named Parker Palmer. Parker Palmer's a Quaker, and I keep on using the word lovely today, I don't know why, but he's lovely. This video is about the story in Genesis 8 where Abraham and Sarah welcome the stranger, and it's called Welcome the Stranger, so I'm just gonna, it's like 6 minutes long, and then I'm gonna read a poem, and then we'll get to our get towards communion.
I've always been intrigued by the fact that there are critical points in the scripture, in both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, where welcoming the stranger turns out to be a real fork in the road as the story is told. So you have Abraham and Sarah in their tent at Hebron, these two elderly people, and strangers approach them from the distance. There must have been some fear in them. They're alone, they're elderly. Who knows who these people are? In our society, there'd be a lot of fear. You're at a national park where you thought you were alone, and suddenly some strangers start coming at you through the trees. Our response probably is to get into the truck or get into the tent, grab the handgun, and prepare to defend ourselves. But Abraham and Sarah say, "You're strangers. You've come a long distance. You must be tired. You must be hungry. Sit, eat, drink. We extend to you our hospitality." And of course, in that act, they learn that these strangers are God's representatives who have come to deliver the good news that a child will be given to them, and that he will fulfill God's promises through that child. God's promises will be fulfilled to the Hebrew people. And then there's a parallel story about the disciples on the road to Emmaus after the crucifixion, where they're downcast. Jesus is dead and gone as far as they know. They're on the wrong side of a lot of things, including the powers and principalities at that time. And this stranger approaches them on the road. It's a story we all know. "Why are you so downcast?" And they say, "You must be the last guy in town who doesn't know what just happened." And he says, Oh, ye of little faith, don't you remember the prophecy?" And they essentially say, yeah. Don't talk that way to us. It doesn't make any sense, but it's getting late. You're a stranger. Come with us and have a meal." And then the famous line, which always moves me when I hear it or think about it, "And he was known to them in the breaking of the bread." This was the risen Christ, of course, talking to the disciples. Well, if Abraham and Sarah had not welcomed the stranger, the Hebrew Bible would only be about 8 verses long. I think that happens somewhere around the 8th chapter of Genesis. And if the disciples had not welcomed the stranger, the Christian church might not have been formed. There wouldn't have been these witnesses to the resurrection event. I think that the stranger has a very special role in Scripture as one who gives us another angle on the news, the good news, and all the news. Because the stranger comes from a different place than we do, sees different things than we do, has heard different things than we've heard, and is able to give us a bigger picture of who we are and where we are and what the possibilities are than we could possibly get all by ourselves. If we stay within our own lifestyle enclave or our own sense of who our family is and who it isn't, we keep getting the news from the same sources, and we keep recycling it, and we keep breathing the same air, which can get very stale after a while. But if we reach out to the stranger, we begin to pick up different messages. And again, our view of the world becomes larger. And because we're taking in the otherness that we know is out there, but we're always kind of afraid of, and we're learning that we don't need to be afraid of it, that it can actually expand and deepen our lives, we feel more at home in the world through acts of hospitality to the stranger. At least in my life, that's proven true time and time again. And I think it's right at the heart of democracy as well as faith. It's another one of those intersections between Christianity and the demands of a healthy democracy. To extend hospitality to that which seems other than who we are, to, as Marge Piercy says in one of her poems, to know who we mean when we say we, and each day mean one more. Each day mean one more. Keep growing that definition of we by encountering the stranger, learning from the stranger, offering food and drink to the stranger, breaking bread with the stranger. And I think always, from where I sit, the stranger may not see it this way, but I do, always, he is known to them in the breaking of the bread.
This is the poem, The Low Road, that he referred to by Marge Piercy. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up, they can bust you, they can break your fingers, they can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember, they can take your child, wallop your lover. They can do anything you can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight, you can refuse, you can take what refuge you can, but they roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob, a snake dancing file can break a cordon, an army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity in your own newsletter. 10,000 power in your own paper. 100,000, you're your own media. 10 million, your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again and they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean, and each day you mean one more. Isn't that lovely? That, I think, is what Welcome the Stranger looks like. That each day when we say we and know who you mean, each day we mean one more. So we keep reaching out to the stranger and we make strangers our friends. And the next day we find another stranger and make a stranger our friend. So this season we're inviting you all to fast. And we're fasting because when we deliberately set aside our habits, we make space in which to change. We make space, and that doesn't always happen, but we make space where God can work when we choose to fast. And so this week I would like to invite you to fast from creature comforts. One of the things that isolates us from when we were a stranger is that we're a lot more comfortable now. And so what we want you to do this week, what we're inviting you to do, is to think about the things that keep us comfortable, and maybe even to think, like, what do other people in the world not get that I have every day that I just take for granted? So let me give you some examples. One of the creature comforts I have is I have the ability to be entertained anytime I want. I just turn on the television. I turn on Netflix. I can distract myself whenever I want. I can just be entertained. One of the things we learned, this is really fun. So we've done this Christmas banquet almost since we started the church. And this year, the Breakfast Club talked to some of the folks at the Breakfast Club and found out that you and I all take it for granted that on playoff weekends or big basketball weekends, we can just gather with friends and watch the game whenever we want. I mean, we've had the TV in our kitchen going pretty much all weekend with basketball on all the time. And what we found out from some of our Breakfast Club friends is, you know what? When you don't have a home, it's really hard to get to watch the game that everybody's talking about. And so this year, Christina led our team, and we did a NFL playoff party and fed them food that we all take for granted, fried stuff. And we're going to do it again. Other creature comforts. This morning, I woke up at 5 a.m., which is my Sunday morning custom, and I have a bench in my shower, and I went and sat on the bench for 10 minutes in scalding hot water trying to wake up. Most of the world doesn't get to shower every day. Most of the world for sure doesn't have hot water. What if you gave up hot water this week to remember when you were a stranger? What if you, this is one that Jennifer has said is not happening in our family because it only impacts her. What if you gave up your washer and dryer for a week and you scrubbed your clothes down by the river? If you live by a river. She said that felt like it was just her doing something this week and the rest of us not. What if you gave up your dishwasher? What if you slept on the floor? Because most of the world sleeps on some kind of a mat on the floor. What if you slept outside? Jewish people have done this for years. In the festival booths, they build tents in their yard to remember that place where you were a stranger. For this week, go live in your tent in your yard to remember that time where you wandered and you were strangers. Maybe I have a closet full of shoes. What if you wore the same pair of shoes, one pair of shoes all week like the rest of the world? What if you wore the same jeans all week long? Oh my gosh, that sounds like fun for me. Jennifer gives me an eye roll usually after about 4 days in the same jeans. But what if like the rest of the world, you like many people in the world, you just chose one outfit for the week and said, that's it. Not everybody gets to walk into a closet full of clothes every day. I'm just gonna live in one pair of clothes. Maybe this week, I don't know what the world eats on. I think it's like $3 or $4 a day. What if you chose this week to say, every day I'm going to live on $3 or $4? What if you didn't have hot coffee every morning? Much of the world doesn't have access to a hot cup of coffee every morning. I'm not going to pick it for you. Honestly, this is the one in the whole series that would be the most fun to do with your family. And so we'll have a family conversation later. We've started it already. But we're going to have a family conversation later today about what can we as a family, what creature comfort, and just understand, the whole purpose is not to win Lent, all right? You don't win by picking something harder than everybody else, but rather, what can I give up this week that will help me remember when I was a stranger, when I didn't have, when my family didn't have, when we were immigrants? That today there's people living in refugee camps all over the world. How do I live this way this week in a way that helps me remember them, that might open up space in me to change my views or change my actions towards those others? Does God want to change something in me? And if I open up space to remember when I was a stranger, will God do something there? So what we're going to do is what we've been doing all during Lent. I'm going to pray, and then I'm going to give you silent space. Anybody not get a card? Did we get y'all? Good. If you have extras, just pass them back to the middle and we'll get them after the service. But so here's what we want you to do. Here's the invitation, is to take your card and write down whatever it is you're feeling compelled to do. And I understand if you're in a family like ours and you need to consult each other, that's fine. Just put whatever's in your heart right now. And then you can negotiate it out with your spouse or family, or maybe you want to do this with your small group or something. And then after the silence, Dustin is going to transition us towards the Litany of Penitence and Communion. And when you come up for Communion, you can pin them to the wall. There's push pins right here. And I got to tell you, this week, and don't put your name on them, this week I came in here, I think on Monday morning, and just spent some time reading the wall. And you're such beautiful people. Some of you are just really embracing this and really leaning in. And there's just, my invitation after the service, if you want to come up and read the wall, read the wall. They're all anonymous as far as I know. I couldn't recognize anybody. So let me pray and then we'll be quiet for a couple minutes while you fill out your cards and then Dustin will lead us. God, privilege is really that thing that just totally sneaks up on us. If we don't think hard, it's easy for us not to even remember that on cold nights, people sleep out on the streets. And people don't have the opportunity to have the diets that we do, or the clothes that we have, or just all the things that make our lives comfortable, multiple cars and transportation and all those things that make our lives so different than the way most of the world lives. And so God, most of the time I think we just forget that we were strangers too. And so maybe this week, in our choosing to give up a creature comfort? Maybe change in us our thoughts, our attitudes, and our actions towards the people that are running on the outside lane. God, I don't believe that you're calling us to feel guilt for the good gifts that you've given us, but I think you do call us to put our gifts to use, to shorten the lanes for everybody. So be with us in this week. Guide us into something. I know that I can go on all kinds of self-help projects, but I want to be sensitive to, Holy Spirit, what you're inviting us into right now in this moment. In your name I pray, amen.